Michael Casey, I'm super excited to say this. We have a veritable smorgasbord of movies to talk about premiering in theaters. We've got some great sci-fi, some quirky comedies, and up first is a brand new drama called Mass.
Yeah, we definitely have two big ones to talk about this week, but I wanted to talk about Mass first because it's a little film. It's a very quiet film, but it's also very good, and it's very, I think it fits in with the community in which it's coming out in. This will be playing what looks like a one-week engagement at the Landmark Esquire starting today. And this is the debut feature from writer-director Franz Kahnt. And this is about two sets of parents, Gail, played by Martha Plimpton, and Jay, played by Jason Isaacs. And then the other pair is Linda, played by Ann Dowd, and Richard, played by Reed Birney. And they've come together in this small Episcopalian church to have a conversation, because they both want to talk about their sons. Both of their sons are dead. Both of their sons died in a school shooting. And one of the parents, their son was the shooter. Now, in addition to that, one of this couples is together. The other one is separated. I don't want to give away who is who and which is which, because that's kind of, I hate to call it a trick because it sounds kind of like a gimmick, but the first 20 minutes of this movie, you're not 100% sure who is attached to whom. And that works really well. What also works really well is that this is a very contained conversation with, there's just a small back room. So there's like a table, four chairs, a crucifix because they're in a church, a box of Kleenex, and like a few bottles of water that are in the back. And the fact that like cinematographer Ryan Jackson Healy and editor Huang Yanghu can keep this visually and emotionally engaging is a real feat. And I really do like this movie. I think it's really engaging. I think the writing is top notch. The performances are even better. You could definitely see this as like, it could have, if it was a stage show, that this would definitely look like a film play, but it was produced during the pandemic. So there wasn't a whole lot of stage shows going on. So it makes sense that it was turned into a movie. And I definitely think that you want to seek this one out. It toys with you in like the way you want a movie to, especially when it comes down to conversation and where people come down on certain sides. One of the fathers here is so engaged in his politics and his activism and like these talking points about gun control and mental health that he has convinced himself that there's a one simple root cause for why his son is dead, even if his wife doesn't agree with him, and certainly not if the people on the other side of the table don't agree with him. It's this back and forth that really makes this thing sing. And like I said, the performances are great. You can check this one out. It's playing at the Landmark Esquire. And again, that is Mass.
And also premiering nationwide this weekend is the new Wes Anderson film, The French Dispatch.
Yes, the long-awaited, much-delayed French Dispatch. This is supposed to come out pre-pandemic as well. And this one is, I love this one a lot. I thought it was so much fun. This is might be one of Anderson's zaniest films. It is almost like a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life. But if you don't know who Wes Anderson is, he has these very distinct style to his movies. He made Rushmore, he made Life Aquatic, Grand Budapest Hotel, and they are almost immediately identifiable by the way he shoots his movie, whether it's the formal compositions, the planimetric framing, the fact that he cuts along 90 degree axes, that the insides of interiors all look like dioramas, and that landscapes kind of look like these giant Richard Scarry like paintings. The dialogue is even Socratic, the characters are very peculiar, there's a very fastidiousness to Ed, which worked out really well, especially when he does like stop motion animation. And that is all on display here. And it is all on display, like turned up to like 10. And he even throws in a couple other textures in this movie. He's got 2D animation. He's got nudity for the first time in this film. He has black and white cinematography that transitions to color and back again. And you try and figure out why it's doing this sort of thing. He is just assaulting you with all of these different textures. And it's almost as he's trying to see if he can push his personal style, his brand of Wes Anderson films, to a point in which it just shatters. And the fact that it doesn't is one of the feats of this movie. But the other thing is that this is very funny. Now, the story is, it's like the title says, it's the French Dispatch. This is a weekly magazine that is modeled after the New Yorker. So they do pieces on like about towns, about going on. They cover the arts, high and low, science, politics, all that kind of stuff. The movie is broken up into four vignettes, so it's designed to feel like you're reading the magazine from cover to cover. The first vignette, Owen Wilson's character takes you on a bicycle tour of the city in which they're at, which is Ennui-sur-Blasé. That's the made-up French town that should give you an idea of what kind of humor you're going to get into. The second story is about a a modernist painter who's on death row because he beheaded two bartenders. Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, and Léa Seydoux star in that one. The third one is a French student revolution, kind of set in the 60s. And here we have Timothée Chalamet and Frances McDormand anchoring that one. And then the final vignette is a story of a world-class French chef, but it's kind of wrapped up in this story of the police commissioner's son being kidnapped. And I don't have the time to go through all the different names are in that one, but the main character that you want to focus on is the character that Jeffrey Wright plays. It's Roebuck Wright, and he's very much modeled after like James Baldwin. And actually all of these stories have like this anchor in these different references, but I don't really feel like Wes Anderson, his movies don't feel like ripoffs or derivative of other works. They feel more like they are actually pointing past themselves to different works of art. So when you watch the section about Del Toro's painter who's incarcerated, my immediately thought was Charles Wilford's short story Pickup, which is a great story that everyone should read. It's a mid-century crime short story. It's a couple hundred pages. It's great. Revisions of a Manifesto, which is the second story with Timothée Chalamet and Frances McDormand. That borrows very heavily from Jean-Luc Godard's Masculine and Feminine, which is a great movie. Again, everyone should see these things. I think this is just a lot of fun. And he has so much fun with this movie. And there are so many different reference points that, like, I think everyone who watches it is going to pull something else out of it. They're also going to discover a lot of different things to get into. I know that his work is very hit and miss with a lot of people. It's been very uneven for me as well. I think that when his movies miss by a mark, they miss by a mile, but when they really hit, I mean, they're just kind of these transcendent things. And I really dug The French Dispatch. It is out now. It's available at most theaters up and down the Front Range. So go and check that one out.
Of course, Wes Anderson is known for gathering an entire cadre of actors to his films, one of whom is Timothée Chalamet. And we'll be seeing him as well in the nationwide premiere of Dune this weekend.
Yeah, and as great as Chalamet is in The French Dispatch, he is equally bad in Dune, which is kind of a bummer because I think he's a pretty good actor, but performances is not really the point in Dune. This is the latest adaptation of Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi novel, and this is actually part one. That is not a spoiler. That the title shows you right up front that this is going to be, I don't know how many movies. I mean, Herbert wrote many books, so who knows how long they string this along for. The biggest disappointment there is that this is going to be an incomplete story. This is more or less just the first act of a major story. And the story is pretty cumbersome. They try to thin it out as best they can. Basic premise is that there is a planet called Arrakis, also nicknamed Dune because it's primarily composed of sand dunes and these craggy rocks. And on the planet of Arrakis, there is a substance called melange or spice. There's a lot of names, nicknames in this movie. It's sometimes kind of confusing. Now, spice is a powerful hallucinogen that the natives of the planet use for medicinal qualities. It's got like longevity powers. You can live forever with it sort of thing. But it can also be used to make interstellar travel happen. So whoever controls the spice, whoever mines the spice, is wealthy beyond any imagination. And the emperor of the galaxy oversees everything, including who mines on Arrakis. And for years, it's been the House of Harkonnen. And for some reason, he's decided that the House of Harkonnen is out and the House of Atreides is in. And so we have a new contingency going to the planet of Arrakis, and they have to deal with the natives. You don't have to squint at all to see that there are shades of colonialism. Wherever the movie's going to go with this is going to have to be left for future installments, because it's just suggested, it's not actually delved into. But all of that is really just window dressing. What really matters here is that Paul, which is the character played by Chalamet, is the one. He's the Messiah that will come and lead the uprising and free the people. He's the one who's going to go native, and he's going to become one with the inhabitants of Arrakis. It's got that Joseph Campbell hero's journey monomyth going on sort of thing. But like I said, none of that really matters, because what matters about this movie, and the reason you go see this movie, is because this has some of the most gorgeous drop dead special effects you're ever going to see. I mean, this movie just bowls you over with images. And like, I really want to point out the work here from the costume department, which is Jacqueline West and Robert Morgan. The production design is by Patrice Vermette, and the visual effects team is, you know, very numerous. They're all under the guise of the director, the Canadian filmmaker, Denis Villeneuve. And they make these massive scales of just like these planets and these spaceships and these sets, and everything just dwarfs all of these figures. And it's just immense. It's just this immense movie. And the cinematographer, Greg Fraser, he doesn't waste any of it. He shows you everything you want there. And so does the editor, Joel Walker. Like, you want every bit of this, whether it's just a simple close-up of Chalamet's face or this massive battle that's between ground troops, aircraft, spaceships. Like, you soak it all in. And if you do, you can really enjoy yourself. It's really quite stunning to look at. And if you are going to go see it, I highly recommend you go see it on IMAX. The bigger the screen you see this thing on, the more you're going to enjoy it and the more you're going to gloss over how thin the story is. This will also be streaming on HBO Max starting now, because that is how Warner Brothers is releasing all their movies this year. And I don't think the small screen is going to do the visuals or the story any favors. So if you're going to go see it, definitely see it in IMAX.
Well, finally, Michael Casey, of course, it's October. And with that comes lots of super fun horror movies. And this week, you want to talk about a very special slasher pick of the week.
Yeah, this we're going to talk about an Italian giallo film. This one is entitled Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. And if that title doesn't tell you, then I really don't know what will. This is Sergio Martino's 1972 Italian giallo film. And if the word giallo is unfamiliar to you, it is Italian for the color yellow. Because back in the day, the pulpy crime novels were printed on this low quality paper, and they all had a yellow cover to them to like signify to people like that's what these are, their crime murder mysteries. So that got carried over when they started making those books into movies called giallo films, or gialli as plural. And they were very popular in the 70s. And they're really the kind of the predecessor of the American teen slasher flicks of the 1980s. But the difference here is that while American films can be somewhat chaste and puritanical in their approach to sexuality, giallo films are way more lurid. And that's exactly what you get here. You get lots of sex and nudity mixing with blood and violence. And it stars one of the queens of giallo. Her name is Hedwig Vink. She is one of the lockstone actresses of the movement. But let's talk about the story a little bit, because this is based loosely on Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat. And it revolves mainly around this middle-aged writer who's a pop writer, but now he's blocked. And because of that, he's grown to hate pretty much everything. He hates his wife, he hates his mistress, he hates his housekeeper. He hates the counterculture that comes out and hangs out in his room and drinks and does drugs and all that kind of stuff. The only thing he really likes is his bottle of J&B scotch and his black cat that is named Satan. And his mother, who he loved very dearly, but she has died recently. And actually the cat was originally the mother's. And she and him had what I imagine to be a very unhealthy relationship, which is probably why the cat hates the wife and the wife hates the cat. And this sets up this just a whole lot of tension. And there's just a whole lot of seething rage. But then we have the first murder of the movie. The writer's mistress turns up dead with her throat slit. And of course, the police suspect him as suspect number one, but they don't actually have anything to pin on him. But then when his housekeeper dies in the same manner, he has to convince his wife to help him hide the body, because there's no way the cops are going to buy that both his mistress and his housekeeper died and he had nothing to do with it. And that's where a little bit of this giallo humor comes in. And then it goes wild from there, because that's when his niece shows up and she's played by Hedwig Vink. And it just gets bonkers. I should mention that the writer, the husband, is played by Luigi Pistilli, and then the wife is played by Anita Strindberg. And half of the fun of this movie is that they know what movie they're in, and they play it to a T. The other half of fun of this movie is that the last 20 minutes come at you totally sideways. If you think you know who the killer is and why the killer did what they did, there's no way to predict this one. You're in for a real treat. And there was another reason I want to talk about this movie, is that because next week, Edgar Wright's new movie, Last Night in Soho, comes out. And that is a movie that's very steeped in gialli. And it overlaps in some really great ways with this movie. So if you're up for it, consider this prep work for Last Night in Soho. And you can go ahead and check out Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. It's streaming now on Shudder. Or if you're in the mood, you can go ahead and pick up the Sergio Martino collection. It is a new Blu-ray from Arrow Video, all restored, looks great. Check it out.
Well, Michael Casey, for more information about you and for your reviews, where can people go?
Go to michaeljcinema.com. That's where you're going to find more about Dune and Mass. You can go to boulderweekly.com, or if you're in the county, you can go ahead and pick up the paper. That's where we have this week's review of The French Dispatch. And check back here next week. We'll have one more slasher fix, and we'll also be talking about the Denver Film Festival.